Sairam, dear listeners, welcome to yet another episode of Radio Sai Answering Booth, a show of questions and answers. Questions yours and the answers, Swami's of course. Well, what about me? Well, I am just a co-explorer with all of you. And as many have told me, the questions don't merely belong to the person asking the questions or is not specific to that person's situation alone. It's a question that either bothers us and we've not asked anyone and someone else is voicing our concerns, or it may be a case of questions which are hidden inside and we've not given them much thought. I guess the questions we receive on the show are like that. At least I can personally relate to many of the questions asked on this show, and I'm grateful to all those who have asked questions because they've given all of you the opportunity to dive deep into Swami's revitalizing message, and with all of you, me along with you too. But above all, let us offer our pranams to Swami, who has created this whole opportunity for each one of us. We receive all kinds of questions for this show, but as I always keep saying, the best ones are those that are about practical situations that we face in day-to-day life. Because whatever is the philosophy or spirituality we learn, we must be able to utilize it in our everyday life. That is why asking the question, what does Swami want us to do in this predicament of ours, or what does Swami want us to learn, is a very important question to ask. And I'm glad that today we have one such question, or rather two questions related to one practical situation in life. But as always, there is one custom to perform before we get to that, and that is the quote that I have for this week. Well, this week's quote is an interesting one, for it is actually a poem, and it's not from any ordinary poet, but from the poet of all poets, Kavim Kavinam, as the Vedas describe. Yes, you guessed it right, it's a poem Swami would recite during his discourses, and it is one of my all-time favorites. I'll first recite it in Telugu, then I'll give the meaning, and then it's a very, very beautiful quote. This is how it goes in Telugu. Pichulu pogattu pichi pattinchunu Sachidanandudu Sai Baba. Kanniru teppinchu kanniru tappinchu Chinmayamurtiyo Chinni Baba. The meaning of that verse is, the one who removes madness and also makes you mad is the embodiment of Sachidananda, Sai Baba. The one who brings tears and also wipes away your tears is the personification of awareness, the young Baba. End of quote. That's a poem that is sweet, profound, and reassuring all at the same time. When Swami would recite it, Swami would explain it himself by saying, Swami removes from you the madness of the world and makes you mad for God. Swami will wipe away our tears, tears of despair, and will make us shed tears, tears of bliss. Now, when we would sit in the mandir day in and day out, or for that matter, when we are here at Radio Sai and listen and observe the journey of many, many devotees who have come and who are still continuing to come to Swami, we get to witness this poem acting out in everyday life. We've seen so many going into that interview room crying because they must have lost a loved one or would be facing some disaster in life, and they will come out smiling. Similarly, we've seen many people come to Swami with an attitude that they don't need God, with that arrogance, with that stiffness, and we would see them break down to tears, moved by Swami's love. And madness? Well, you just have to come to one of Swami's hostels to see that madness yourself. I guess we all have a certain amount of inherent madness, as Swami would say. We are mad after wealth, power, name, fame. But once Swami steps into our life, for once, we are mad for the right thing. We become mad for Swami's love. And that is what we would see in the hostels of Swami. It's unimaginable for students of that age to be so obsessed with something so supreme. But the credit doesn't go to the students, or for that matter, even devotees of Swami who experience this madness. The credit goes to this sweet Lord who makes us all mad for His love. And of all the things that Swami can do for us, He can take us from zero to hero, He can cancel cancer, He can raise us from the dead, He can fulfill each one of our desires. Of all these things, the greatest gift that Swami can give us is to make us mad for His love. So if anything is worth seeking from Him, it is only this one thing. Let us pray. Swami, give me love for You. Give me such love that makes me mad for You. Before we head to the question, dear listeners, Permit me to read that beautiful, beautiful Telugu poem one more time with its meaning. Pichulu pogattu pichi pattinchunu Sachidanandudu Sai Baba. Kanniru teppinchu kanniru tappinchu Chinmaya Murtiyo Chinni Baba. The one who removes madness and also makes you mad is this embodiment of Sachidananda Sai Baba. The one who brings tears and also wipes away your tears is this personification of awareness, this young Baba. And then let's head to the question that we have for this week. As I said, it's a couple of questions based on one situation. It's my young listener who wishes to be anonymous, so I will not be mentioning any details about him. And it's a pretty long question in the sense that he has given a long explanation for where the question is arising from. So I've decided to read it myself. I'll read it out and let's see what answer we can come up with for that. My query is a combination of two questions, both related to each other in my context. Question one, what is Swami trying to teach one using separation? Any kind of separation, including death, divorce, etc., is a very painful moment. It becomes unbearable, especially when that person is very close. Is Swami trying to teach something very, very important using separation? Or is it just part of fate that had to happen? Question number two. What has Swami said about intercaste marriages, especially when one person is from the highest Hindu caste, Brahmin, and the other is from a lower caste? We know cases where Swami has personally performed intercaste marriages. I've scanned all Satyasai Speaks, Vahinis and other popular literature on Swami to see what he has said on this. All I could find is that Swami saying caste of humanity doesn't mean that we can go and marry anyone we like, as culture is different from caste. When Swami performs such marriages means that he is not against them, else he wouldn't say one thing and do another thing. I do not know if Swami has privately spoken about such things in Trayi Kodai, etc. This is the context for the questions. I fell in love with a girl from a Brahmin family. We loved each other for 3 long years and she's been the best thing that happened to me in my life. Her love filled in a kind of hollowness and loneliness I've been having since my childhood. I say this because my parents separated when I was just 11 years old. That incident left a severe trauma in me, something I'm still trying to come to terms with even after 15 years. Staying with just one parent has affected me in many ways. I've forgotten what it means to live in a family. At times, my self-confidence was affected and left me depressed. With Swami's love and grace, I did manage to be normal by studying well, getting good jobs and not getting into unnecessary habits, though it has left some kind of a void in my life. And when I fell in love, I considered this person as Swami's blessings and love flowing in abundance. But unfortunately, the girl's family is not okay for an intercaste wedding. They are also devotees of Swami for decades and feel that it is a sin to marry someone from a lower caste. They think that Brahmins have a responsibility to continue their culture and traditions. Marrying someone else will be a black mark on their culture and family. So they have decided to get the girl married to someone from the Brahmin community itself. I loved her more than I loved my parents and siblings. Even she reciprocated it immensely all through. I know I worked hard for this and have done everything possible in my hands. Both of us have also prayed intensely to Swami to intervene, but so far he hasn't responded. She is also helpless and has now decided to accept her parents' wish and as she is out of time. But for me, this is another separation in life. I'm sure Swami would not just take two people apart unless there is a strong reason. Should I even try to deconstruct this or just accept it as marriages are decided by Swami taking into account many things from the past, present and future. Thank you so much for your time and attention. I would be deeply grateful if you can help me understand what Swami said about these things. Well, this is the question and the context for that question. I thank the brother for explaining it so much in detail, because that gives us an opportunity to understand where the question comes from. Well, I can sit here and philosophize, I can give you reasons, I can read Swami's discourse and tell you, but I do acknowledge that the pain is real when you're facing it. And it's, whatever I say here is not to in any way make your pain feel silly or make you feel belittled by it. If at all I sound like that, I apologize in advance for that. But of course, it is important to look at it from the spiritual standpoint, and I think that's what we always try to do in this program. We look at everyday life and situations that we come across, but what is it that we need to learn from it? And if we have to look at it from the perspective of Swami's message, how do we look at it? So there were two questions. One, of course, about what are we supposed to learn from this pain of separation that is inevitable? I think all of us go through it at some stage or the other. In some form, it's not necessarily with a person of this nature, but in some form, either through death or divorce, as you mentioned in your question. And the second one is, of course, about intercaste marriages. So I thought I'll start off with this question on intercaste marriages. The one on separations is more general, and I think there's more to learn from that. I'll keep that for the second half of the program. We'll start with this question on intercaste marriages. What does Swami say about intercaste marriages? Well, of course, for that we'll have to first ask, what does Swami say about caste itself? Definitely Swami doesn't give importance to things such as caste and community, or absolutely right in that. And isn't that the reason why Swami always says there's only one caste, the caste of humanity? Especially if you're in India and if you're going through this educational process in India, this is a question which will be asked of you multiple times as you go through your education. What caste are you? Thanks to the reservation system that is still prevalent in our country. But it's unimaginably different when you're a student at Swami's institution, because Swami has literally brought that culture in, you know, what he says in his discourses. It's literally lived out in his institutions, in that sense that we go through our schooling and our education in the university with absolutely no idea of what is this caste and who is what caste. In fact, there was one of our teachers in the school who was telling about a student who did all his schooling in Swami's school, right from the primary school. And the first time when he was applying for a different college outside, there was the section in the application form which said caste. And as innocently as he could be, he wrote humanity in that. Because that's literally, we're not even brought up with an idea of which caste we belong to. And that's how, you know, Swami has always brought us up. And Swami always sets a very high standard when he's explaining some of these concepts also, right? It's a reality. You cannot say that castes don't exist, because we definitely follow that in many, many faces in life, at least in India, as I said. You know, even though we want to overlook it, it's part of our life. But so Swami would always give explanations that are very, very lofty and very sublime, and would exhort us to understand some of these things through that process, right? There is this very beautiful incident which one of our seniors had narrated, and this boy happened to be from one of these villages which are predominantly houses of, you know, all are Brahmin households. I think there are still some villages in South India like that, and he belonged to a village like that. So one day Swami asked him, you know, are you a Brahmin? Swami said, are you a Brahmin? And this boy, almost coming from that background of traditionally being brought up, and probably brought up with this idea that being a Brahmin is a very superior thing, and you know, with pride, this boy replied, yes Swami, I am a Brahmin. And Swami looked at him and Swami said, you, are you a Brahmin? And then Swami said, you are a Dunga Brahmin, which means you are a fake Brahmin. Dunga means actually a thief. So Dunga Brahmin means you're faking that you're a Brahmin. You're a Dunga Brahmin, Swami said. The boy was a little taken aback by it, and he said, no Swami, I am a Brahmin. And he went on to explain, Swami, I am from the Atreya Gotra and all that. Swami said, all that is fine, but you're not a Brahmin. Are you a Brahmin? Swami asked. And this boy was at the loss of words how to explain this to Swami. And then Swami went on to explain to him, you know, he must have been a boy of about 15 to 17 years old. But, you know, this is the explanation that Swami was giving him. And Swami said, look, by birth, all are lokas. Right? There is a shloka which I had quoted earlier too. Janmana jayate shudraha. So Swami told him, by birth, all are lokas. Only through karma you can become a Brahmin. Swami explained further. He said, see, if your father is an IAS officer, will you also be an IAS officer just because you're born to that person? You have to study and clear the exams, isn't it? And the interesting thing was, this boy's father was indeed an IAS officer. And this is the first interaction Swami was having with him. And, you know, it was another level in which Swami was connecting to him through these words. So Swami went on to say, similarly, just because you're born in the lineage of Atreya, sage Atreya, does not mean that you're a Brahmin. A person who knows Brahman alone can be called a Brahmin. Right? So this is the standard that Swami set for us in the sense of even understanding these concepts. Forget about following these concepts. Even when you're trying to understand the idea of a Brahmin, Swami said, this is how you have to think. And even, you know, it's not a class which is given to you only by birth. So even though Swami did not encourage discrimination based on some of these things like caste and creed, Swami still encouraged the continuity of tradition which goes with some of these aspects of life. In fact, the above interaction which I was telling you about, the student whom Swami was asking, are you a Brahmin? It was happening when Swami was actually handing out these sacred threads, or what you call yajnopavitams, you know, when on one particular day during the Shravana month, they're supposed to change these sacred threads. And in those days, Swami himself used to hand out these sacred threads to the students who had this tradition of wearing that thread and doing that puja relating to that. So this interaction which I mentioned happened when Swami was actually handing out threads. So in that sense, Swami was encouraging the tradition of this. And we know Swami himself would perform these thread ceremonies. And earlier, Swami himself would, as I said, hand over these threads. And even till the very end, Swami would always bless at least these sacred threads which were used by the students. So Swami would always be pleased if, you know, even students from some of these Brahmin families and traditions would continue some of these traditions, such as the Sandhya Vandanam, or for that matter, even when Muslim students would practice the Ramzan fast, Swami would be very, very encouraging of that. I recall one of the old students telling, he was a Buddhist student, and he came from one particular sect in Buddhism. And apparently one day Swami called him for an interview, and in the interview Swami started speaking about that particular form of Buddhism that his ancestors have worshipped. And if I'm not wrong, I think Swami even taught him some chants which were specific to that tradition of Buddhism that he is from, and thereby encouraging him to, you know, practice some of those things which came from his ancestors. So Swami doesn't give much importance to this idea of caste, because, you know, much of the segregation that we see in the name of caste and creed, these are all based on profession, and these are all based on some of the roles that you play in society. And today it's completely irrelevant in that sense. But at the same time, Swami encouraged this cultural continuity, right? So, and I think you made a mention of this even in your question, where you said that Swami speaks about culture and not caste. So let me read out those lines that you're making a reference to for the benefit of the listeners, where Swami tells in a discourse, he explains this idea of cultural continuity in the context, especially intercaste marriages, right? This is an excerpt from a discourse that Swami delivered on the 8th of March, 1997. So these are Swami's exact words. New fashions can be noticed today. Swami has said, caste of humanity. Well, yes, it is true. Since Swami has said caste of humanity, many think that they can marry anybody. Swami has only said caste of humanity, but not culture of humanity. There is culture and one needs to follow it. What is one's culture? What is his tradition? What is the use when one forgets goodness in one's own culture and takes to worldly ways? There are no caste differences for Swami. All belong to one caste, but there is difference in culture. Because of the differences in the culture, the lifestyles too are different. One must consider this. It is fitting, if it fits their convenience, people say, Swami has said so. And when people don't want to do something, they don't conveniently quote Swami. End of quote. So this was the clip which, this was the discourse which the questioner himself was making a reference to. And clearly Swami explains that, yes, he does not give any value to caste, right? So as Swami has many, many times said that he wants us to transcend some of these sectarian beliefs. So it is not as much about purity or superiority of caste as much as it is about the continuity of culture that is important when Swami is referring to this marriages, right? Such cultural continuity becomes easier when people marry within the same traditions, right? It's not that one caste is higher or the other caste is lower, but for this one purpose, one of the purposes, I'm going to speak of another shortly, one of these purposes is this continuity of tradition and continuity of culture is possible when marriages happen into the same tradition. But having said that, but still this becomes pretty irrelevant when we come from very, very modernized cosmopolitan families, because you've already forgotten all your culture and traditions, right? And that becomes a, if you quote this example of following cultural tradition, that's why we'll marry into the same caste, then I think, as Swami was saying, you're misquoting Swami, or you're quoting Swami for your convenience, because you do not follow any of the traditions which you're supposed to follow. But then when it comes to marriages, you're quoting that. Similarly, the other way, you know, you will have to look at giving this continuity of tradition and continuity of culture an importance when you're looking at marriages. As Swami told that student, you know, we do nothing that a Brahmin is supposed to do, but just we want to hold on to that status of superiority which comes from the past, right? That is wrong. That is what Swami is saying there. There's another reason which is, I feel, more relevant, and I've even spoken about this before. Swami has also emphasized on this. Traditionally, the idea of a marriage is never about two individuals, right? Marriage was always considered as two families coming together, or in other words, a woman becoming a member of another family and a man becoming a member of another family. This transition into a new family, Swami says, is much, much easier for everyone involved in this this institution of marriage if there is a commonality, especially a commonality of lifestyle, and that commonality of lifestyle comes from commonality of tradition, right? And this is something which Swami would say. Swami would say this in the interview room to youngsters, that it becomes easier, this transition becomes easier and becomes more comfortable when there is a certain kind of commonality. So it's always easy for two individuals to have, you know, when you're talking just about two individuals, it's very easy for them to have understanding, right? You just have to be a little more accommodative with each other. But when we see marriage as a union of families, as Swami always wanted us to, taking along everyone becomes very, very important, right? And that's what Swami says, when people of the same tradition marry, adjustment becomes easier. That's the word Swami would always use. Adjusting becomes easier when there are some commonalities in tradition. So having some common ground becomes very, very helpful. And when you were referring to Swami making, Swami performing marriages which were, which were not strictly within the same caste or within the same tradition, there the commonality was actually this devotion to Swami. And I know you made a reference saying that even the girl comes from a family of devotees, but you know it doesn't always go that way, because when Swami performs marriages which are, you know, which is interlinking between two different traditions or castes or however you want to word it, where families give more importance to devotion to Swami and their Swami being the center of their life starts to define that family, I think in such cases that one commonality is more than enough. And that is where Swami actually performs marriages which are over, you know, there are many, many cases like that where Swami probably gets a South Indian married to a North Indian or a Gujarati married to a Sindhi. And Swami would say this because they have modeled their life in such a way that Swami has become the center of their life. Swami's activities defines their families more than any other cultural tradition. In such case, this one commonality is more than enough, right? So intercaste marriages or caste marriages are not the one to be considered. Is there acceptance from both families? Are all the individuals involved likely to be comfortable with each other in this, when going through with this institutional, in this particular marriage? For this purpose, marrying into common traditions is useful, right? It's just a good starting point. There is no guarantee in any way, right? It's not like marriages that happen within the same caste are going to last longer. I don't know if anybody's done a study like that. It finally all comes down to how, as individuals, we work out and whether we are patient and we're ready to accommodate each other. So there is no guarantee in that sense. But as a starting point, you're at least starting with some commonality and starting with some common ground. And, you know, that is why this is useful. So as individuals, you don't have to worry as much about caste and religion or creed as much as you have to worry about having the consent of the elders in the family. I think that is what is the most important thing to look at, especially your parents. They have to be considered. Their willingness and their approval is very, very important, right, in that sense. And, of course, the point on continuity of tradition, what Swami has so much emphasized. I know, I mean, matters of the heart is very difficult to explain once it happens, right? You know, it's when you start liking a person this way, it's very difficult to go back and reason like this. But at least for youngsters who are, you know, who are in the process of getting into a marriage or getting into an alliance like this, I think it's very important to keep this in mind. Well, once, as I said, once it becomes the matter of a heart, it becomes very, very difficult. I think the second half of the program is going to be about that. How do you deal with such kind of separations and such kind of disappointments in life? But before we get into that point, before we get into that phase where we, you know, fall for someone and then wonder, is it the right thing to do? It's very difficult to retrace your steps after that. If you can, well, these are Swami's instructions. Whatever is the case, I think it's better if you can get the approval of all the elders in the family, especially the parents of the girl who's involved and the boy who's involved. Well, that's the answer that I wanted to give about intercaste marriages, what Swami has said on many occasions and what Swami has said to couples when they were getting them, when he was getting them married or whatever. Now, let's come to this other question and the larger question, actually, and more important one to look at. The idea of separation in general. Why does Swami put us through separation? What does Swami want us to learn when we go through such pain, especially when we go through the pain of separation? Yes, in a sense, you are right. Pain is just a part of life. That's something Swami always keeps saying, that you cannot avoid pain. Pain is just an interval between two pleasures. Pleasure is an interval between two pains. And any number of times Swami has said that life will have challenges, there will be obstacles, there will be ups and downs in life, right? And in fact, that itself is a lesson. I think this is one thing which is very, very prominent in Swami's message itself. You know, as devotees, when we first come to Swami, this is one thing which will strike us. Swami does not only say that I will protect you and I will remove all your pains and I'll remove all your sufferings, but at the same breath, he also emphasizes that you cannot wish away all your pains and troubles. There will be ups and downs in life. There will be challenges and you need to accept it. So that itself is a teaching in itself, that life is part, pain is part and parcel of life. Now, when we go through life, this is what we generally try to do. We are constantly trying to pursue happiness and at the same time, we are trying to avoid pain, right? And invariably, that's how we make every decision in life. We're constantly wondering, okay, this is down the line is going to lead to pain, or this is down the line is going to give me more benefit. So we avoid one and we go after the other. That's how we constantly keep making decisions, and there's nothing wrong in that. Invariably, that's how we go about life. And we also try and avoid situations that can land us in trouble, and we are constantly chasing events and objects that can give us pleasure. But Swami says that pain is inevitable. Only the amount of pain that we may undergo in life may differ from one person to the other. And that, Swami says, is based on the actions that you have performed, the consequences of your actions, right? Then why are we programmed to avoid pain and seek pleasure? if pain is inevitable and we are going to face pain, then why are we programmed in our mind to avoid pain and seek pleasure? If there's no way we can avoid pain, is this just a cruel joke which is being played on us? That we have been programmed in a way to avoid pain, and then we are told that there will be pain. You cannot escape it. So is this some kind of a cruel joke that Providence is playing with us? Well, not really. There's a bigger lesson that needs to be learned through this, and that is what Swami is trying to teach us. That is what Swami's message is trying to lead us to. As I said, we pursue happiness and we try to avoid pain. But there's another thing that we try to do in the process. Not only do we do things that will give us happiness, but at the same time, we are also constantly trying to secure that happiness. In other words, we want happiness, but we are also doing things which will prevent events from taking away that happiness from us, or we are trying to get such happiness that will last the test of time, right? So not only do we want to be happy, we also want to ensure that the happiness lasts, right? And I think that's a very, very important thing to note. That's why we do everything in life. You know, whether your investments, your insurance, your pension planning and all of that, you know, whatever we do is not only to secure happiness, but we also want to make sure that the happiness lasts over a period of time. So seeking pleasure and avoiding pain is actually not the essential human behavior. Swami says that is actually the animal behavior. It is the animal that is programmed to constantly go towards pleasure and avoid pain. Seeking happiness that is long-lasting, happiness that is eternal and not ephemeral, that is the true human behavior. What we refer to as Sashvata Anandam, right? That happiness which is eternal. To seek that happiness is the nature of human being. To seek pleasure and avoid pain is actually the nature of an animal. And this is the subtle point that we need to keep in mind. And this happiness that is eternal, that cannot be taken away by events in the world, you know, cannot come from the world. Because what the world gives, the world always can take away. Then we become those who will live at the mercy of the world, right? So what happens in our life, that is what is happening in most of our lives. We are looking for happiness that the world can give, and that will eventually be a happiness that the world can take away, right? It has to be something that is beyond what the world can give, because only that happiness can last and cannot be taken away by the events that happen in our life as we live in this world. So whether we realize it or not, whether we acknowledge it or not, this is what we all are looking for in life. We are looking for happiness that lasts the test of time and that is actually beyond the pain and pleasure that we face in everyday life. So how do you get this happiness? That's the next question we would ask ourselves. Well, that's what spirituality is all about, right? That is the essence of all spiritual learning. All that we do through spirituality, be it Advaita, Bhakti, or whatever form of worship or whatever path of yoga that you're talking about, the whole idea is to get to this happiness which cannot be taken away by the events that happen in our life. But I'll explain this of how do we get to this happiness based on the context of the question, because the context is the pain that comes from separation, right? So we will take it on from that point of view. There's this very beautiful Chinnakatha that Swami would narrate. There are many, many versions of it. I don't know if the version that I'm going to narrate now is exactly what Swami has said, but the theme of the thing or the idea behind the story is pretty much the same. The story goes that there is this wandering monk or wandering sage, or how we would like to perceive it. He goes to this one particular village and he sees one man who's absolutely despondent. He's a broken man. He's crying and he's sobbing. He's sitting all alone in his house and he's crying. So he asks the people around, why is this man so, despondent? What is the problem with him? And they tell him that, you know, he's just lost his wife and he was very, very attached to his wife and he's lost her to some disease. And that's why he's inconsolable. It's been actually more than a week now, but he's not able to gather himself together. So the sage goes to this particular man and asks him, you know, why are you crying so much? So this man says, you know, because my wife is dead. So the sage pursues the question a little more. So why are you crying? So this man says, because my wife is dead. So the sage asks, so the death of your wife has caused you this pain? Is that what you're trying to tell me? And the man says, yes. So you think that death is the cause of your pain? So he says, yeah, she's dead and that's what is causing me to pain and that's what is making me so depressed. So then the sage goes on to say, look, if death is the cause of your pain, then you should be eternally crying like this because someone or the other is going to be dying in your village or in fact in this world. Every minute somebody is dying. If death is the cause for your pain, then you should be eternally crying and there cannot be even one moment when you can be happy. And then this man says, I mean, why am I going to be crying for everybody else? This is my wife and she's dead and I'm crying for it. And then the sage tells him that, so that means you're not crying because of death. You're crying because it was your wife who is dead. It's not because your wife is dead, but it is because your wife is dead. And the reason why he emphasized this was, he says, it is not the death which has caused you your pain, but it is your attachment that has caused you this pain. This what we refer to as mindness, or in Sanskrit what we refer to as mamakaram. Right? He says, because it is your wife, because you feel that my wife is dead, it is causing you pain. So the pain is not caused by death. The pain is not caused by the separation that death has caused, but the pain comes from this feeling of mine. Because if it has got to be separation and if it has got to be death, it is happening all through the year. Every minute someone is dying and every minute somebody is leaving the world and going away. It is because it is your wife you're crying. So that is where the source of your pain is, this mamakaram, right? So when we go through life, what do? We try to ensure nothing happens to my wife, my children, my family, my property. And if we are a little more broad-minded, we are thinking about my city, my country, my planet. But it's a losing battle that we all are waging. Because everything in this world is finite and will perish at some point of time or the other. So this is what we are doing all through our life. We are defining what is mine in the form of property, in the form of family, and we labor all through life to protect what we have labeled as mine. And as I said, what the world gives, the world can always take away. You know, it always has the strength to take away. And that's why it's a losing battle. How much ever we labor, at some point we are going to lose it, right? So this is a losing battle that we are engaged in, and we will be going through this pain over and over again in different contexts. Sometimes it might be losing a wife, sometimes it might be losing a lover, sometimes it might be losing siblings or even pets, your property, your house or whatever it is. So what are we supposed to do? What are we doing right now? Till I am alive, I will protect all that is mine. That is what we are trying to do, right? You know, the whole problem is when I am alive. If I am dead and there's mine, something happens to it, who cares, right? By then we would have moved on to a different body. So as long as I am alive, I try to protect whatever is mine. But the problem with this is, this feeling of attachment does not go. Swami says this feeling of mine comes, once it arises from the, from our mind, it stays. When this body dies, it enters another body and it starts attaching itself to another set of people, another set of things, another set of properties or whatever it is. So we are in this frame of mind that all through my life I will protect whatever is mine, and I will protect it till my last breath, and then I'm fine. After that I'm free. But it doesn't end there. We are again born with that feeling of mindness. Just that now it is, then we say it's my wife or my husband, it's a different person, that's all. But that feeling of mindness is there, and as long as it is there, we are vulnerable, right? But in the path of spirituality, juxtaposed to what we do in the worldly path, is we try to get over this mamatvam or mindness, right? We are trying to sublimate this feeling of mindness. And once we do that, then the world cannot make us sad. right? This is the difference between what we are trying to approach life as a worldly path versus what we try to do when we are trying to approach life in the spiritual path. Well, it's not that you can just discard this feeling of mindness one day, but you just have to, you have to overcome it through wisdom or jnana, as Swami would say. Because that mamatvam or mindness also has a relevance, right? Till the point when we have that absolute wisdom or jnana, I think we cannot discard this mamatvam altogether. It has a relevance. How is it relevant to us in our daily life? Because the same idea of mind is what defines our dharma. As Swami would say, the essence of the Bhagavad Gita is mama dharma. To perform one's duty becomes a path in itself. And that mama dharma also comes from the same mamatvam, right? So same mamakaram is what gives that idea of mama dharma. Okay, so and so is my parent, and so is my colleague, and so is, this is my nation. That is what defines dharma, as long as we attain that absolute wisdom which removes this mamatvam completely. That's why, just because I'm telling you that you have to give up this idea of mindness, you cannot walk out of your family and say that, you know, there's no mind. Swami says that you have to labor through that mindness, because you need that mamakaram for mama dharma, right? That's why, even though on one hand I'm saying overcome the idea of mind, I am also saying that you should ensure that your family is pleased with your decision when you choose a person to marry, right? That's what I said in the first part of the answer. You have to take the opinion of your parents, and you should be, they should be giving you their approval, and that is very, very important, right? So on one hand, you're supposed to give up this mamatvam. At the other hand, as long as you are under the influence of that mamakaram, you're supposed to define your dharma based on that. So what is the role of the separation that we go through in life, and how does it help us in acquiring this wisdom, which is eventually going to help us overcome this feeling of mindness? This is a beautiful story, and I'm sure I must have narrated it sometime before, either on this show or any other show that I'm part of. And I'm sure most of you must have heard it too, but the message that the story gives is so graphic and it is so striking. I'd like to narrate it here because it perfectly explains the context that we're trying to understand here. The story goes that there's this poor fisherman who is on the bank of a river, and when he suddenly realizes that the water has become very, very turbulent, and there is a flood upstream. So in this flood, this river water is flooding, and it seems to have lashed through a village. Excuse me. And he sees that all kinds of objects are being washed away along with the current. And he's standing there at the banks, and he's seeing this river flow, and then he notices that there's a golden bowl shining and looking all precious is being washed by the turbulent waters of the river. The moment he sees that, he realizes that this is a very, very precious thing, and it can make him richer by so much more. So he jumps into this water. He's after all a man smitten by poverty, right? So he jumps into the water and he catches hold of this shining bowl, golden bowl, and he's trying to come to the shores of the river. But he realizes that this is a big bowl, it's quite heavy, and the water is quite turbulent, and he's not able to keep himself afloat, holding this bowl in one hand and just swimming with the help of this other hand. And finally, he comes to a point where he realizes that if he doesn't let go of this bowl, he's going to drown. So he lets go of the bowl and he swims, he escapes from the turbulent waters and comes to the banks. And once he reaches the banks, he starts weeping aloud, he starts beating his breast, and he starts crying. He says, "Oh God, what a misfortune has befallen me." He says, "My bowl is gone, I lost my precious golden bowl, I lost all my money, I lost all the good fortune that I would have made." Right? And he starts crying and weeping, sitting on the banks of this river. The story goes that there's a wise man who is there on the banks, who is seeing this whole scene of this poor man jumping and trying to get that bowl. And he comes up to him and says, "You fool, when was that yours to lose? It came in the tide, it left with the tide. For a very, very brief period, you jumped into the water and you held it in your hand. How can it be yours? And when it is not yours, how can it be your loss?" This is what the wise man asks. And if you think of it, this is the case with all of us, isn't it? We look at somebody, we look at something that we have gained or something we have earned, and we say, this is mine. We do not realize that it has come with the tide of life and it leaves with the tide of life. And for a very, very brief moment, we hold it in our embrace and we say, this is mine, right? The moment we realize it, this story looks like, this story shows this man in as a simpleton, right? It's such a foolish thing to do. It was never yours. You lost it. Why are you crying over it? But isn't that what we all do? Something which was never ours, which was ours for a very, very brief moment, we let go of it, or time takes it away from us, and then we start crying that, oh, I've lost mine, I've lost mine. As that wise man told it, he told this poor man, you know, how can it be yours when it was not yours? How can it be your loss when it was never yours, right? So good, bad, close, distant, people, property, whatever it is, in this flow of life, we meet many, many things and people in the flow of life. They are taken away from us, right? And we keep flowing with life. That is what life is. We meet midstream and we part midstream. And when we forget this, that is when we are actually lost in that pain of separation. And Swami gives this, explains this through many, many analogies. There's so many beautiful Chinnakathas which Swami says. And another one which conveys this message so beautifully is Swami says that we are all traveling in a train. Different people get onto the train at different stations, and when their station comes, they get off, right? And when your station comes, you also have to get off. For that brief period between one station to the other, we make friends with those people or we make contact with them, right? And that is what is life. People come when their station is, it is their station to get onto the train, and when it's their station to get off, they get off it, right? And that is, we're all co-passengers in this journey. But again, I'm not saying that the pain of separation is unreal, or that's what I said in the beginning. I'm not saying that, oh, it's so stupid of you to be having this pain. And a heartbreak is a heartbreak. And when our dreams are shattered, the pain is very, very real. However illusory it is, when we are undergoing that pain, we suffer that pain, right? That's the predicament. And that's why it's not a pain to be looked down upon or belittled. It is a pain when we are going through it. But as I was explaining a few weeks ago in the context of another answer, you know, pain has this tendency of making us focus all our energies and, you know, literally makes us blind to the past and the future, and it makes us concentrate on that pain that we are undergoing. In fact, this is an experience that we all have physically witnessed it. You know, a small cut in your finger or a small wound in your leg or any injury like that, especially an injury which is painful, you would experience this. You know, it'll draw all your attention to that pain. How much ever you try to think of something else, that pain will be nagging, and you'll eventually end up thinking about that pain. And this is about physical pain, and physical pain to an extent can be overcome when you get your mind preoccupied. But emotional pain is so much more difficult because the pain is being undergone by the mind itself. So, it, you know, especially if it's a very depressing pain, if it's a very, very strong separation, if it's a very dear person that you've lost, that pain becomes so very overpowering, and it's not easy to overcome, right? So at that moment, we tend to feel that life is lost and life is not worth living. We are never going to be happy anymore. I think that's another feeling which comes, that all that could make me happy is gone, and I'm never going to find happiness again. But the fact is, it's not true. It's not real. Once we go past that moment and we are able to look back, we will see that it was just another event in life. It's just another occurrence in our life, and we have come past it, right? That ability to be brave and ensure that, you know, pain is a natural thing, and you know, there's nothing to be worried about it. We will go past this too. We will overcome this too. You know, that comes with faith in God. And that's what is so important when Swami comes into the picture, right? Because as I said, at that moment, everything looks lost. And when we are able to just come past that moment, when we look back, we find that, all right, it was not so bad. And after all, life is looking up again, right? But to come past that moment, you need something to hold on to when you're in the middle of that. And that is what comes with faith in Swami. And when we say that, you know, Swami must have some reason for me to do this. That's what you mentioned in the question itself. You know, there, Swami knows what is best, and it's right. You know, two people coming together in a marriage is based on so many karmic reasons, right? Unless we have some give and take, it doesn't happen. So if a marriage happens, or if a marriage doesn't happen, or if a marriage lasts for a little time and does not last after that, everything depends on the innumerable gives and takes that we have with that person and with the person's family and all the others whom we're going to be associated with. So definitely there is a reason for separation. But when we have Swami in our life and we turn to Swami and say that, you know, Swami will not put me through a pain if it is not essential for me and if there is no reason for that. So I can't see the reason right now. I can't see why I have to suffer this way. But definitely Swami must have a reason. When we have that attitude, we are able to go past that moment, which is so very powerful. It really sucks our energy. It really pulls us down to that pain. We are able to go past that moment when we have that, you know, attitude of faith in Swami. So when we have this attitude over a long period of time, when we have this attitude as a habit, as Swami would say, you have to constantly keep telling yourself, whatever happens is good for me. Whatever Swami does for me is good for me. It becomes a habit and an attitude by which you look at life. When that happens, we tend to start observing life with a certain amount of detachment, right? We're looking at it, and we just see how happiness goes when separation, you know, it just comes and goes. Be it happiness, be it separation, we just look at it and we just see it as it comes and goes in our life. We see how pain stings and how with time that sting goes away, right? So when we start seeing life's events in this manner, we develop what Swami refers to as vairagya, right? Or detachment. We are able to look at our own life with a certain amount of attitude of distance. When failure happens, we will be detached because we know that it's just part of the course of life. Similarly, when success or happiness comes, we know that this is also momentary. Let us not rejoice too much. Let's just observe it and let us not take it too seriously, right? And when we have this detachment or vairagya, when we are able to distance from our life, when we don't get sucked into every pain or every elation that we face in life, Swami says, eventually this will lead to viveka, right? Viveka is nothing but wisdom. And viveka, Swami says, is the ability to distinguish between that which is eternal and that which is ephemeral or, you know, momentary. What Swami would refer to as nitya anitya vichara viveka, right? The ability to see what is eternal and what is ephemeral. Which happiness is worth pursuing because it is eternal and which happiness is momentary, which pain is momentary, which we should not give it much importance. That viveka or wisdom will come when we are able to observe our life with an attitude of distance, right? Or doing what will lead us to eternal happiness is the question which will eventually come to us and we will start looking at doing that, right? And this is nothing but the quest for the ultimate or moksha. You know, moksha is not some heavenly state in some eternal or ethereal superworld or something like that. It is nothing but just securing what we referred to as earlier Sashvata Anandam or happiness that cannot be taken away by the events in the world. And when we are constantly trying to see what actions will lead me to this moksha or what attitude or what am I supposed to do, that is nothing but what Swami refers to as mumukshatvam, the desire for happiness that is eternal, desire for happiness that cannot be taken away by the ups and downs that we face in the world. That will come, right? So vairagya will lead to viveka and that viveka will lead to what we refer to as mumukshatvam. And in between all of this, as I said, the mamatvam is still there, that mindness is still there, and that mindness decides our dharma, our righteous action at that moment. And as Swami has beautifully explained, when we constantly perform the actions that we are meant to perform, that we are supposed to do as part of our dharma, Swami says, it will lead to chitta shuddhi or purity of mind. And this is what is again referred to in our scriptures as the shat sampatis or the six forms of wealth. Of course, it is defined by sama, dama, uparati, and I think we've spoken about that on many occasions. Swami says that all of these things of self-control and sense-control and mind-control and forbearance and patience, all of this comes when we perform our duty within this idea of, you know, this is my duty. The same mamatvam which we are trying to sublimate, we use it to define our duty. At the same time, we distance ourselves from our life. We see ups and downs as all ephemeral when we hold on to the faith that whatever Swami says is best, whatever pain I'm undergoing is right, and you're able to see it with a little bit of distance. It's not that you will stop suffering. You know, pain is painful. Happiness is joyful, right? It does give us up and down. But to an extent, we'll be able to stand apart from all of this and look at life and say that, you know, this is part of life and I need to do that by which I will be able to find happiness that cannot be taken away from all of this ups and downs that we face in life. And this is the reason why, you know, separation is very much part of life. Because if there is no separation, if we are constantly getting what we want, we will never learn. Even for that matter, even as something as simple as sports, you know, always they say that it's only the defeats which will make you sit back and think. And victories, you know, there will always be lessons. You will always look at, okay, we didn't do well in these aspects of the game. We need to concentrate on this. But that focus and intensity will always come when there is a defeat, when there is always a failure, right? That's why failures are the best teachers that we have. And when we are able to look at it from the spiritual standpoint, it's not that we will try to avoid that failure, but we will realize that what the world gives, the world can take away, and I cannot bet my happiness on this kind of joy that the world can give and take. And that is why when you lead a spiritual life, it is, I mean, oftentimes this question arises, you know, what is the hurry? If at all, if we're going to come in multiple lives and we're going to die and be born again and die and be born again, we have enough time, right? We have eternity to figure out where moksha is. But the problem is, it's like a reset button which keeps being pressed every time that we end our life. Of course, the spiritual benefits that we carry are carried forward to the next life. But to a certain extent, you know, let's say you live till 80 years and you've gathered so much of wisdom, you've, you know, listened to all the satsangs and all the discourses of Swami and you've gained a little bit of understanding mentally. And if we have not internalized that wisdom, then one moment comes, the body dies, and we're again born a small child, and again we go through the process of getting attached to family, getting attached to our siblings and friends, and it's a certain amount, we are set back by a certain amount. That's why that urgency to, you know, reach that ultimate as soon as possible, if possible in this very birth, that urgency should be there. And if that urgency is there, you know, you will look at life differently. I know it's very easy for me, as I said, to sit here and talk philosophy to a person who is undergoing the pain, but brother, all I can tell you is, you know, we have to keep in our mind that Swami knows better. In our short-sightedness, we look at a person and say that this is the best person, this is the best thing that can happen to me, and this is the only thing that I wanted in my life. And, you know, we could define our pain in any way like that, but Swami knows best. And if we are able to believe in that and hold on to that thought, we will be able to coast through that particular moment. And once we do that, we will see that, all right, when I could find another person, I could find love. You know, life did look up after that. And, you know, that vairagya comes when you have faith in Swami. So that's all I had to say. And I hope what I said about the intercaste marriages also gave you a little bit of clarity for the context of the question that you asked. Thank you for asking this question. All the very best to you, and if you have anything more to ask, feel free to ask me. With that, dear listeners, it's time for me to wind up this week's answering booth. If you have a question, feel free to write to me. You can write to me at prem@radiosai.org. That's prem@radiosai.org. If you wish to be anonymous like the questioner today, do let me know. I will not mention your name. If you can record your question in your own voice and send it across, that would be brilliant. I can play it and then answer the question. I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's lotus feet, who has given us the opportunity to dwell on his beautiful message over and over again, week after week, day after day. Our heartfelt gratitude to Swami and a heartfelt gratitude to all of you for giving me this opportunity to be a part of your exploration. I'm going to leave you all with a very beautiful Hindi song which Swami students would often sing in his presence. On the other side of it, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu and his team for the last segment of today's Thursday Live, the Vahini Satsang. Happy listening.